Welcome to this Better Angels interview special. I'm your host, Sarah Brown. This episode features Tom Fletcher, a former ambassador to Lebanon, one of the youngest ever appointed, a former Downing Street advisor to three different British prime ministers. He's also the author of a new book on diplomacy in the digital age called The Naked Diplomat. And he has a passion for a world where every citizen is their own diplomat, where creativity is fostered and valued across jobs and industry, and where every child has the chance to go to school and learn. I sat down with Tom to explore all of these things and to get to the heart of his optimism about positive change. So, welcome, Tom Fletcher, to my podcast studio here in Washington, D.C., where we temporarily are. I'm talking to you today about your role working in the Foreign Office, working as an ambassador, as Britain's youngest ever ambassador when you were appointed, for 200 years, and now championing global education. And I want to talk to you about all of those things and your book about digital diplomacy.
Terrific. Thank you.
Before we get into all of that, I want to hear about Tom at school. You know, what was school like for you? What were teachers like? What made you enthusiastic about school?
Well, I think I was probably a bit of a square at school. I'd come from a family of teachers. In fact, I'm the black sheep of the wider Fletcher family, as the first person in three or four generations not to become a teacher. I spent a year as a teacher, but wasn't that good at it, which is why I have such admiration for teachers now. But I was lucky to have several kind of life-changing teachers along the way.
So which of your teachers stand out, or what made a difference from those teachers?
Well, I think actually I've been lucky really with teachers all through life, including since leaving school. And many of my best teachers have been in government and outside government and way beyond the school buildings. My very first teacher, Marge Francis, was fantastic, taught me, you know, the basics. And then I had a really wonderful history teacher at my secondary school who taught me basically to ask questions and not to take for granted what I was being told, to be curious.
And did you always know all the way through your secondary school that you would go on to university? Was that always your goal to...
Actually, it's funny you should say that, because my biggest telling off at school was when I was 6 years old. And we were all lined up to get our work marked by Mrs. Hurd, the teacher at the time. And she overheard me saying in the queue that I would be the first person in the class to go to university. And she quite rightly thought that was incredibly arrogant and cocky for a six-year-old. But I guess I did always have a sense that that was where I wanted to end up. My dad had been the first person in his family to go to university and took me up to see his old college and so on when I was eight or nine. So I guess he planted the seeds in my mind then.
And what did you study at university?
I studied history. I was rejected first time round. I applied to do English and wasn't good enough for English to get in. And then went off and spent a year as a teacher and then came back again, got some decent A-levels, and they relented and let me in.
And what made you try again? Because it's a really interesting thing to kind of stumble and fail. That's a hard thing to do. You know, some people would take that failure where they felt they weren't ready for university at all, or they'd pick a different place to go and study. What made you dig in, come back and have another go?
I think probably deep down there was a competitive streak in there somewhere. I'd certainly... For almost every job I've ever applied for and almost every university place and so on I've applied for, I've looked around and thought, oh my God, these guys are all so much better than me. How will I ever get this place? But then the moments when I have been knocked back, I then thought, oh, come on, you can do this. And so that was certainly the case with being rejected first time round from university. I think as well, you know, like many people who go off and do something else for a year, you do breathe a bit. And you're more attuned as a result to what matters to you.
And was that the first memory you have of something not working or something you set out to do not being successful?
Well, I failed my driving test when I was 17 or so.
That was a big three times.
That was a big knockback.
It's deeply humiliating.
And I mean, subsequently in life, I mean, before becoming a diplomat, which I kind of found a way to do reasonably well, before that, I'd been a failed singer in a band. I'd been a failed boxer and a failed door-to-door salesman. So I tried lots of different things.
And do you see them all as failures, or do you see them all as things that you were doing for that time and then you moved to something else?
Yeah. I mean, they weren't crashing disasters, but I don't think I was kind of troubling people who could do these things well.
So just a small segue, the band, the singer in a band?
Yep, Freshly Squeezed.
Freshly Squeezed, nice.
You may not have heard of them. a few people have, but they were very big in Southeast Kent in the summer of 92. And, you know, every now and again, rumours start circulating again that Freshly Squeezed could make a revival.
And could they?
20 years on. You know, I think there's public demand, but we've all grown up a little bit. We've all got a bit larger and a bit more bald. And I think we've probably become better musicians as time has gone on. So maybe. I wouldn't write it off.
So from university, was it a trip straight to the Foreign Office from that moment?
Yeah. So I did the classic university round that most people do in their last year, when suddenly they realise that they're going to have to go out and earn a living, and reality starts to seep through. And secured various kind of classic graduate jobs, oil companies and consultancies and so on. And I never really thought I would get the Foreign Office. At every stage, I was running up against people who spoke 17 languages.
How do you get into the Foreign Office? Do you have to sit an exam or interviews? Or
it's a really grueling year of sort of three-day assessment centres, interviews and so on, language aptitude tests. And in the end, the final bit of it is that they basically map out everyone that you've ever met in your life, and they go and talk to most of them to find out whether you're the right kind of character.
Did they
job.
Talk to the members of Freshly Squeezed?
They did. They did, unfortunately, because. But actually, what they're doing through that process is not to ensure you're completely squeaky clean. In a way, people who are completely squeaky clean probably wouldn't get through it all. What they're trying to do is make sure that they know more about you than anyone else, so that you can't then be blackmailed by Russia or China or whoever's being particularly hostile to us at the time.
And do you think they're also looking for the kind of people and team they want to join the Foreign Office? So it's not just about the university degree you have, it's about other skills and aptitude you bring.
And that's actually something that's quite distinctive about the UK Foreign Office. If you look at, say, the French or most European systems or the American system, very, very heavily academic. And you're picked because you're in the top 10 that year academically. The Foreign Office, you know, of course, what degree you get matters, but not as much as your interpersonal skills, your leadership potential, and so on. So it's a very different type of person, I think, that they're looking for as a diplomat than many other foreign ministries. And in fact, many other ministries in the UK.
So I know that you went on to be the youngest ambassador in your late 30s, serving the British government in Lebanon. But there's quite a few years from the moment you arrive at the Foreign Office, where you're working in the Foreign Office, you're working at number 10 Downing Street, you work for two British prime ministers, serving them on foreign policy issues. Not to kind of skate over that too rapidly, but what's that journey where you're starting off as the new recruit and the next minute you're standing side by side with a prime minister at an important moment and providing advice and guidance on what needs to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a completely smooth journey. It goes in lurches, really. And so it's very much sink or swim. You get put into a new job, a new position. You have to learn it very, very fast. And just as you feel you're getting the hang of it and you've built your network in that job, and I got sent out to Kenya for 4 years. I was in Paris for 4 years. You build up a fantastic network of contacts and you get to understand the subject. Then you get hooked out and put in something completely different. And the biggest one for me was coming back from Paris in my fourth year there and being dropped into Downing Street. So very, very much at the heart of government. And as you say, suddenly being in the room as world events are happening around you. A massive privilege, but there's nowhere, you can't look around and expect someone else to have the answers at that point. You have to scale up very, very fast.
So without betraying any government secrets for whatever the advice you're saying, what's the sort of moments that you find yourself in, or what's the sort of role that you play in those moments?
So it can range completely. It's everything from providing policy advice to seeking out Pro Plus at the end of a long, difficult European Council. There's relationship management. You're actually trying to get the best out of the Prime Minister's relationship with his or her foreign counterparts. You're trying to really understand what's coming at you in these big international meetings. So you've got to understand the personalities of the other leaders around the table. You're also trying to get the best out of the UK government system on behalf of 10 Downing Street and on behalf of the Prime Minister. And so there's a large kind of management aspect to it as well. So it takes a lot of stamina, and you need a certain amount of resilience as well, because you know these positions are never going to make you very popular, because you spend a lot of time pushing the system hard to deliver. I mean, ultimately for the UK taxpayer.
And how do you decide to do that? I mean, it's quite difficult to choose a job where you're proactively deciding to be slightly unpopular with people that you're dealing with day to day.
Yeah, I think it has to come from a belief that what you're doing as a diplomat matters. And I think, you know, the greatest diplomat of all time was probably the first caveman who found the way to persuade the other cavemen to stop clubbing each other over the head and go out to hunt collectively. You know, they were the original diplomats. And so there are these big competing instincts in all of us, survival of the fittest versus an ability to collaborate over finding resource and sharing resource. And so the best diplomacy is in that space around coexistence, negotiation, trying to find ways to help people rub along as states and societies and businesses and ideas rub up against each other. And if you believe in that fundamental mission of diplomacy, then you can soak up a certain amount of unpopularity and abuse along the way. And I don't want to be too down on it. It's you know, the moments of unpopularity are far outweighed by the exhilaration of being at the G20 summit or walking into the White House, as I did again today after 7 or 8 years since the last time, or of being there as history is made. There's nothing like the pressure you feel 10 minutes before Prime Minister's questions and 12 o'clock on a Wednesday when an issue is breaking and there's no time to go and get the answer from anyone else. You have to think on your feet at that point. Thankfully for me, I didn't have to actually then go and speak on my feet in the House. That's something altogether different.
I'm interested, I've talked to you a bit about, you know, notion of failures or notion of things you find hard or being unpopular, which is slightly undermines the notion of a career that's actually gone very, very smoothly and landed you with this amazing position as ambassador in Beirut, representing Britain to the people of Lebanon and throughout that region. And you arrived in Lebanon at a really interesting time where we have all the pressures of the Syrian war and people having to leave the country and a lot of kind of intricate relationships across that whole region. How's that, being in Lebanon and being Britain's representative there? That's a very different role. You're no longer the man standing next to the Prime Minister trying to find the notes ready, you know, for those words. You're now the one in the spotlight and you're now the one delivering that message and at the front line of those diplomatic negotiations.
Well, I mean, there's a line in the West Wing about being president where they say you don't learn the presidential voice, you earn it. And you don't really understand what it means to be ambassador until you get off the plane and suddenly you're the person. And somewhere like Lebanon, you feel that very acutely. You get off the plane and suddenly you've got 12 bodyguards whisking you into that that whole world. You know, I arrived with child sick down my top because I had a 3 or 4 year old on the plane with me at the time, and suddenly you're there at the heart of things with a lot of people looking to you for leadership and the vision that you need to get through these quite tough times. People always thought that I must have been given Lebanon as some kind of punishment. People who don't know Lebanon, because it's, you know, the perception of Beirut is, you know, like Belfast or Belgrade, you know, these capitals that have that reputation of being war zones, very divided and difficult places to live. And Beirut is all those things. It's a very difficult place. But if you care about what I talked about before, the, you know, that this idea of coexistence and the role of diplomats in promoting that, then you should seek out places like Beirut. And that's what I did. I asked and begged to go there. I really do believe that it's a real front line in that battle for coexistence. It's a country very divided between different religions. There aren't many countries with such a balance of Christians and Muslims. But also, if you look at its geographical location, right at the eye of the hurricane that's sweeping through the Middle East, much of that hurricane is on social media. And so one of the first things I did when I got there was try to find new ways to use social media, new digital technology, to connect with people in a different way. I mean, what a privilege to be able... No previous generation of ambassadors ever had that ability. They would talk to the 100 or so elites in the country and try and get things done that way. Suddenly, I could speak to everyone who was online. So it completely transformed the nature of the job.
Well, I remember when you first went on Twitter, and I remember putting out a tweet to say, oh, look, Ambassador Fletcher's joined Twitter. And people were really interested. You see that instant flurry where people know they're going to hear right from the person himself, you know, our man on the ground. Did you find that warmth and engagement from Twitter and from other social media sites?
Yeah.
With a direct interest from people, yeah, in what you were doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel very lucky that I came on when I did. I mean, now there's nothing that unusual about an ambassador being on Twitter. When I started, there were, I think, three on. Now, probably half our ambassadors are on there. And yes, you were my Twitter fairy godmother, and you gave me some very good advice early on about following the right people. But also, and this is what I always say to diplomats, ambassadors, anyone now, that importance of finding your own authentic voice on there. And if other people are tweeting on your behalf, then you're not on Twitter, because you're not there able to absorb and respond and, most importantly, engage with what other people are saying. You're just transmitting. And, you know, I try to convince diplomats that Twitter's like this enormous great diplomatic reception, and you wouldn't delegate it. You wouldn't stand in the corner just shouting platitudes. You wouldn't turn up and just be silent, lurking in the corner. You'd be in there exchanging information, you know, the rough and tumble of debate. You'd be having arguments. And that's what's wonderful about Twitter. You can find out, you find those dividing lines, but you can also connect with people in a completely transformational way. So I can't imagine how I would have done my job without social media. But there are lots of different ways to cut through. One of them is, of course, visuals. And like anyone in this, finding out about this digital world, we discovered that the visuals were very powerful too. And when the Iranian embassy in Beirut was bombed, at the time we didn't have diplomatic relations with Iran. And so I couldn't go and pay condolences, and yet I wanted to demonstrate solidarity. And so I went down and donated blood outside the embassy, and of course tweeted the photo of that picture. And that went viral in Iran. It was retweeted by the president of Iran at the time. And it just challenged people's perceptions of the UK. You know, they'd been told it was the little Satan and, you know, this huge enemy. And suddenly, hang on a second, you've got a British ambassador donating blood.
Something very human, yeah.
Yeah, and authentic. But it was also, you know, the smartphone that I was using to connect with people was also the device that terrorists were using to track my movements. Mm-hmm. So there's a very direct trade-off there. But it was always worth it. And often, you know, people would say, but how do you have the time? Actually, Twitter saved me a lot of time, because it meant I didn't have to do all the rubbish that got in the way of real diplomacy, because I was finding a way to connect with people.
I always thought with Twitter, people would say, but what if you say the wrong thing? Or what if you say something you don't mean to say? And I have to say, if an ambassador doesn't know when to say not to say the wrong thing, then you're really in trouble.
Yeah.
So why would you be so direct through Twitter if it's something, yeah, you wouldn't say out loud? And I always think, if you wouldn't say it, don't tweet it.
Yeah, exactly. You should. You have to think before you tweet. And there are risks to being on there. I mean, there were risks, as I say, to my own security. There were risks of saying the wrong thing. And in the Middle East, if you say the wrong thing, who knows when?
Yeah, there's greater consequence.
But the biggest risk is not being out there. If that's where the arguments are happening, you can't leave that space to the bad guys. And in my case in Lebanon, the bad guys were the extremists.
You've been at the forefront of using social media, but you've also taken it to the next level of really looking to try and dig deep and understand what that impact is of using digital technology on the diplomatic world and on diplomacy in general. So much so, you've written a book about it. There's a future there for diplomacy where you believe very passionately that shift into the digital space has the most profound impact. You know, without discouraging anyone from going and actually reading the whole book, you know, just share with me now a little bit about that approach, because you really looked at it from the sharp end, but you've also tried to think about it in the broader sense and looking at it from a global perspective.
Well, I think, I mean, firstly, I mean, it's quite a parochial point around disruption. And all the industries that people are working in now are obviously being transformed by digital technology. And unless you adjust, then you become like Kodak. So diplomacy, like every other industry, has to find ways to use these new tools to not just harvest information, but to engage with people in new ways, but also to build influential campaigns. I worked out I could have much more impact doing a job swap with an Ethiopian housemaid to highlight mistreatment of domestic workers in Lebanon than I could making a speech about it. But you have to then understand how to do that in the digital age.
But how do you work that out? What makes you think of it? Where does that idea come from?
I think it came actually from observing many of the successful campaigns in the humanitarian world, actually. And if you look back at that model since the Glen Eagle Summit, Make Poverty History, the Jubilee Debt Campaign, they completely transformed the conversation between governments and the population. But that hadn't been happening in the Middle East. And so people were surprised. Suddenly I was on Twitter. You know, the Prime Minister of Lebanon came on Twitter in order to talk to me on Twitter. So we were kind of building that plane while we flew it, but drawing on those lessons from civil society and the world outside. But that's the starting point for me. But the end point for me, and it's really where I finished the book, is that diplomacy is now much too important just to leave to diplomats. And it's one of the reasons I've come out of government now, is because I've seen the limit of what governments can do on these big, you know, existential global issues like migration and climate change, poverty, education. Governments are very well-meaning, and much more than people realise. Governments are stacked with people who try to make the world a better place. Not everyone in government is doing that, but many, many of them are. But they're also very conscious of the limits of what they can actually deliver themselves, partly because of resources and partly because of that decline in traditional authority. And so if you're attached as a foreign office or as a government department to the state and to hierarchy, you're finding your influence diminishing. And so you have to go outside if you want to fix these big global challenges. And I think we have to find a much more sort of citizen-driven approach to these huge, huge existential challenges that we face as a species. So what I'm most interested in now is seeking out citizen diplomats. And they exist everywhere. They exist in NGOs who are campaigning on these issues. They exist in the private sector, in business, which is why I'm working with the Global Business Coalition for Education. Many businesses share that desire to change the world for the better. But they exist in communities. Everywhere you look, there are people who are doing diplomacy. They don't call it diplomacy. It doesn't have fancy titles. It doesn't surround itself with all the platitudes of foreign policy and of ministries of foreign affairs. There's no one calls themselves Your Excellency. But on every corner you could walk out here in Washington, you'd find people doing day-to-day diplomacy.
So what does that mean? If you're a young person who's just passionate about making their mark on the world, you've got your Facebook page, you've got maybe your own blog, you've got, whatever social media points they're using to be able to convey their message, how do they make themselves a citizen diplomat? They make themselves a successful citizen diplomat? How do you pick your issue? How do you get behind it? How do you make that difference?
I think the first thing is to recognise ownership of the problem and not assume that there is someone in government or elsewhere who's basically got this one. Because, frankly, we haven't. Sad, I wish we did, but we don't. So I think that recognition, but I don't think that's... my sense is that a lot of people, a lot of younger people now, aren't held back by a kind of being too humble about the influence they can have in the world. There is that sort of confidence in what they can deliver. I think you do have to pick your arguments and not spread yourself too thinly.
And be realistic about what you achieve. I mean, if lack of confidence is not the issue, that overconfidence isn't necessarily something that's going to land you real change.
And stick at it as well. I mean, I worry with social media. I mean, I do worry about slacktivism. I do worry about sort of hashtag activism, just sticking a hashtag on the front of something and thinking that you've actually helped to change the world when you haven't. And there are so many of these issues where we haven't seen through the change that we were all articulating. So I mean, you do have to have that dogged determination to stick with things, because that's how change has always been affected in the past. But recognising that you are now armed with a superpower, this smartphone superpower that previous generations didn't have, that ability to connect with people who share your agenda, share your view globally. I mean, what a fantastic transformational thing to have.
And if you're on the outside looking back at the government, how from the outside can you make a difference? Because while you recognise that government can't change everything, they still hold a big pot of money that can be put to making those changes. They can still make very big sweeping decisions that will affect our lives. You know, if as an individual citizen you want to change something, you can help send one child to school, you can help build a whole school, you can help move something. But if you're a government, you can run a whole education system and make sure that there's a school place for every child. So I really believe that we do need governments to do their best. What we need is everyone else to work in partnership for that common end. But if we all go off and try it and do it separately without government, it's too hard.
Yeah.
So how from the outside do you look back in at government with all the knowledge and experience you have and know how to get the best out of government rather than taking everything you know and trying to achieve it elsewhere?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I mean, I think, and it obviously governments around the world vary in quality and engagement and indeed, you know, a sense of mission. Many governments in the world don't actually care about these issues in the way that governments in the UK are more likely to and often in Europe are more likely to. I mean, I think a lot of it starts with the attitude of government itself. Less than 100 years ago, government sort of public engagement is just something they did very, very rarely. You might issue a speech or you might occasionally do an interview with a newspaper to explain what you were doing, but you didn't feel that sense beyond the electoral cycle of needing to be held to account for what you were doing. And many governments in the world still don't feel that sense of being held to account. Now that's completely shifted, and it's almost unthinkable for a government to deliver a big game-changing policy without a public engagement around it, and not just with the media as it might have been 20 or 30 years ago, but with the public at large through social media. So there's a recognition there that they can't, that governments can't do it alone. I think it's about building coalitions, really, and that's what we're trying to do on the education side. Focusing on very specific objectives. So take, for example, the campaign to get 1 million Syrian kids into school. You know, you've got something there that everyone can grip onto, but also everyone can recognise they can't deliver alone. And so you then look for innovative partnerships between the businesses that can fill the spaces that governments can't fill, but then also the activists and the NGOs who can bring those issues to a wider public to put more pressure on the governments to focus. It's, in my experience, it's very easy in government to be buffeted by the news cycle. When I started in Downing Street, I would often think about policy in terms of what would go on the Sky ticker, at the bottom of the screen, the 140 words that might define a policy. By the time I'd finished in Downing Street, we were thinking in terms of 140 characters. And we were much more likely, the news cycle was getting shorter and shorter and shorter, that sense of being always swept up in the immediate. It's very difficult to be strategic. And so the more that campaigners and those outside can hold government to some more solid, game-changing objectives, the better.
And what about the role of the international institutions? If you think of the United Nations or the World Bank or the IMF, we always had great hope that these big institutions would see countries working together. That's where the big cooperation is supposed to be. Are they still the right places to deliver change? Is that still the right approach to have big global cooperation?
So one of the things I've written about in the book is almost a progressive manifesto for how some of these big institutions need to adapt, need to become more responsive to the public, but need to become much, much more coherent in the way they operate. But we've also got to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think there's a one of the dangerous tendencies in the digital age is just to break stuff. It's very easy to break stuff, to disrupt, without having an alternative in mind. And I think we've got to be very, very careful about doing that to the international architecture until we found a way to remodel it and rebuild it. In 1815, or even in 1945, when many of these international institutions were put together, it was easy to know who should be in the room to do it. You know, in 1815, it was the victorious powers who defeated Napoleon, and they invited the French in as well, and it was very clear who was going to sit around the table and design the new international architecture and what the issues were they had to resolve. After the Second World War, it was very clear who should be in the room, and it was very state-based. Now it'd be very hard to work out who should be in that conversation and then to organise that in a coherent way. So while there are huge flaws in the UN and the international financial institutions, I think we have to look at evolution. We have to work with the grain of change, because you know, we haven't yet found a better idea than the UN for global coexistence.
And really, the world's a place that's more interconnected than it ever was. So having a global approach, I think most young people look at it and think, well, I know what someone's life is like on the other side of the world just via my mobile phone. Yeah. I didn't have that when I was growing up. I would have to read about it or watch a television program and very occasionally meet somebody who traveled across who you never saw again because you didn't have Facebook then or you didn't have a means of staying in touch. That must have changed the way the world is, the fact that we know how everyone else lives. And there's no excuse not to do something to alleviate the difficulty of people who live the most extreme and impoverished and dangerous lives.
I mean, I think there are huge advantages to that. And it obviously makes it much harder for repressive governments to basically spin lies about life elsewhere. You know, apart from, you know, say, North Korea and some small pockets, it's very difficult to crowd out the world. And someone was saying to me the other day, if you build a wall around the internet, we'll build an internet around your wall. You know, eventually it gets through, and it will get through to North Korea as well. But it also, as millions more come online, it also creates this enormous aspiration gap, because it makes it much easier for people in much of the developing world to see what life is like elsewhere. And to ask, well, hang on a second, why don't we have the same access to education, to health that we see elsewhere? And that's why I think we are heading towards this great age of migration, of having huge numbers of people on the move, because it's a very natural human instinct to seek out a better life, to go where you think your kids are going to get better education, to go where you think that your healthcare needs are going to be looked after, where you're going to have shelter, and most importantly, where there'll be opportunity. And if you don't see opportunity in your area and you just see insecurity, instability, hopelessness, then of course you'll move. And so we've got this huge challenge as the international community. How do we not just get, for example, kids to school, but how do we get school to kids in those communities on the move? Because if we fail to do that, then those kids won't be in school uniforms, but they'll be in life jackets crossing the Mediterranean, or worse, suicide vests on the metro.
And you mentioned your own life, where you had to be concerned about the threat of terrorism. You mentioned now the attraction for young people to go towards, you know, fundamentalist groups, and to, you know, even get to a point where they've got a suicide vest on and are taking part in something that's going to harm so many others. What's the impact that the digital world has, and the impact that a drive towards greater education has, to actually try and address some of that? Because that makes life very, very scary for people in any part of the world. So what do we do, or how do we approach that, if you think about it from your point of view of both inside government, but also the notion that other people work in partnership to create that change?
I mean, I think it's the battle to get education to every child is the right fight to be in, but we also have to recognise that at the moment we're losing it. You know, the numbers are not going in the right direction, despite fantastic efforts from governments and civil society. So we have to look at new ways of doing this, and we have to look at new ways of using technology to get education through to those who most need it. I think what we're seeing at the moment is not just the disruption of the classic humanitarian model, but also the disruption of education more widely. And you know, one of our partners was saying to us the other day that when we look at the challenge of getting education to Syrian kids, we shouldn't just be thinking about getting education through, but thinking about giving them the best possible education in the world. Because why not? You know, why can't we now get the finest teachers in across the world to be teaching online classes to those students, for example. But I think we have to first to win the argument with business, and not just with governments, that this is their battle as well. And for them, you know, they can see that there is an economic benefit in getting kids to school. They can see that there is a security benefit in not having kids out of school. So it's not just the moral dimension of this. There is a very altruistic case for getting these kids into school.
So what's the next step in the kind of campaigning process for it? Is if you put a call out to people to kind of help and join that campaign, what do they do? What action can they take?
Well, I think one interesting dimension to this, and again, it's empowered by digital technology, is that 10 years ago or 20 years ago, if someone, if a school teacher in Birmingham had come to us and said, how can I help? I've just seen these shocking pictures of Aylan Kurdi washed up on a beach in Turkey, and I'm moved, I must do something to help. Only a decade ago, we'd have said, okay, we know what to do. We, an NGO, or we, a government, know what to do. Donate money to Oxfam, Save the Children. These fantastic NGOs, you've done amazing work out there. Or just lobby your government to do more. I think we're not that far away from a situation where you can actually say, well, what can you do yourself? And so if that individual in Birmingham turns out to be a retired geography teacher who can help mark the homework and do the lesson plans alongside a teacher in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon who's teaching double shift schools and is exhausted at the end of a long week, then that's a much better use of their time and a much more empowering way of delivering humanitarian support. If we've got the technology to do internet dating across continents, surely we have the technology to connect people who actually want to do good in the world. And I think, you know, I think that's one very exciting challenge ahead of us.
Teacher, not Tinder, rather. Yeah.
I mean, we want Tinder for giving.
Yeah.
And I mean, one of the things I do is teach a class at New York University, and we were talking about, you know, how do you bring new technology to solve the old challenges? And this is one of those where I think, yeah, I would love to generate that kind of thinking, but from within refugee communities, from the people who would most benefit, because we've also got to shake this idea that this is about just donation and giving. It's actually about dignity for those communities, because they want what we all want. I always say that those people who are most critical of refugees on the basis of these misguided ideas of what refugees will do in our own societies are the people who've never met one. You know, these are people who want opportunity. They want to get their kids in school. They want the same things as we do. And dignity is a hugely important part of that.
So what next? If you're trying to envision that future for digital diplomacy and being able to use social media, you've talked about the importance of imagery. Certainly all of social media tells us with campaigning that not just static photos, but also short films are really key to sharing a message. And we've just been looking at some amazing 360 virtual reality filming that's come back in, of just seeing the way children are living and having them talk to camera, that you feel that you're there. This digital stuff is all moving very quickly. Where does that lead to with being able to share experiences and tell stories? And
yeah, I mean, I think the message matters more than the medium. So you always have to try to keep up and keep innovating and not get too stuck on one form of communication. I personally, for me, Twitter is the comfort zone. I've never been big on Facebook. I've never really jumped into Snapchat and Instagram and so on. I've probably got a bit too settled on Twitter, because it's where most of the people I'm trying to influence spend their time.
I always liked Twitter because I felt it was within my concentration span. Anything else that needs a sort of longer attempt is taking up too much of your day. You know, you have to live. It's like the weddings where people spend so much time videoing the experience, they've missed the moment themselves.
Exactly.
And I worry a bit about that, where you're working with people creating stories and campaigns, and a lot of it is about the filming and the making of the images rather than being part of it, being part of a demonstration, holding a placard, the physical experience of being standing in solidarity with people because you want something to change, you know. I've done my time outside South Africa House, I've done my Rock Against Racism marches, but that goes back to a time before the joys of Twitter.
Yeah, and in all those cases, it was based on a strong set of values and beliefs that the communications, whether it was a tweet or holding a banner up, was just the tip of the iceberg, but there was a big iceberg beneath the surface. And this, again, this is my concern about a lot of social media activism, is there's often no iceberg. And actually, it's a problem with a lot of policy by governments as well, that we get caught up in the spin of the announcement, how to package it, how to get the film right, or the press statement right, or, you know, whatever tools we're using, and sometimes lose sight of making sure we've got a really solid structure underneath it for the policy itself.
Yeah, if you're calling for something to change, you have to know what it is you want to change and what happens after that happens. You know, sometimes it's careful what you wish for.
And again, stick with it. And it's quite striking that in this education space, 2 or 3 years ago, it wasn't fashionable. But there were groups of people who helped to make it fashionable and will be sticking with it long after it's no longer fashionable, mm-hmm. when everyone's gone on to whatever the new fad is. But you do need the people who will just stick at the issue year in, year out, decade in, decade out, and we'll hopefully see that progress over time, as we are seeing on so many of the poverty indicators. You know, one of the things I've been writing about is the need to find ways to communicate in a different way with the public at large, because I think because people are so worried about the media and worried about being perceived as screwing it up, that we often then fall back on language which doesn't connect with people. And diplomatic language is a classic example of that. You know, we talk about my country views with not a little concern the situation on the border of Zimbabwe, whereas you should just say, this guy is murdering his own people and it's appalling. You know, and I think people have less tolerance for that kind of detached, bureaucratic language.
It's made for some of the best BBC comedy drama.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. It inspires comedians and sitcom writers. And...
Yeah, but I would love it if people just felt more able to speak honestly, including admitting, yeah, we got this wrong, we've learnt from it, we didn't factor in this, the situation changed. I think I only had to delete 2 tweets in 4 years as ambassador.
You deleted 2 tweets.
And as a rule, I think deleting tweets is a mistake, because it's
out. I've only ever deleted tweets when I've spelt things so badly that I'm just totally embarrassed and you have to kind of take it down, like you spelt someone's name wrong or something.
The first one, I tweeted that it was a Sunday evening and I was on a yacht, because we sold more yachts per capita in Lebanon than anywhere in the world, believe mm-hmm. it or not, and Jags and smoked salmon and whiskey and Panadol. Bizarrely. And I was asked to take it down, because we didn't want the public thinking that ambassadors just spent their lives swanning around on yachts.
Eating Ferrero Rocher.
Definitely, there was no Ferrero Rocher. And so I took that one down. With hindsight now, I wouldn't bother taking that down. The second tweet, by the way, I had to take down was, and actually this one I agreed with. I agreed with the fact I had to take it down. I tweeted once about public sector strikes and said, I'm not striking today, but I have solidarity with those who are. Mm-hmm. I think it was a strike over pensions. Mm-hmm. And it was pointed out to me that I could walk down the street mm-hmm. with a T-shirt on and a banner saying that, but tweeting it on a government handle was inappropriate, and that mm-hmm. was absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And so I took that one down.
And got the T-shirt made.
But that was... I mean, I think we're all on this journey with social media. We're kind of learning where the lines are, mm-hmm. and... I'm amazed that there hasn't yet been an ambassador fired over a Twitter slip. I'm sure it will happen at some point.
It's been political aides, political advisors have certainly...
And you've had footballers mess up and so on. It must only be a matter of time, but my wife was very good at establishing rules around when I could and couldn't tweet. And particularly, you know, after 9 o'clock at night or when I was angry, she made sure that the Wi-Fi was disconnected.
Yeah, good advice, I think. So we'll leave the last word with Mrs. Fletcher then. Thanks very much, Tom.